Loaded, The Green Movement and the Struggle for Iran's Future, and his latest book is Sectarianization, Mapping the New Politics of the Middle East.
This is VFR Katura, and you're listening to WGXC Accra 98.7 FM.
Vital Weekly is the experimental new music show from the folks formerly behind Stan Outlaat, an independent record label located in Amsterdam with a separate store in Berlin. Tune in Vital Weekly at 1 a.m. Wednesday after Battlefield Earth.
Wave Farm programs are made possible, in part, by the New York State Council on the Arts, with the support of Governor Andrew Cuomo and the New York State Legislature, the National Endowment for the Arts, the Andy Warhol Foundation for the Visual Arts, the Greene County Legislature through the County Initiative Program administered in Greene County by the Greene County Council on the Arts, the Alexander and Marjorie Hoover Foundation, the Foundation for Contemporary Arts, the T. Backer Fund, the Joseph Family Charitable Trust, and hundreds of other generous individual donors.
All Together Now listens for feedback from the public. Anyone who wants to leave a public comment can call 518-291-9492 and leave an audio message up to 3 minutes with any sort of opinion about something you heard on All Together Now. You can also...
Network, this is the news. This is the network. This is the news. This is the network. Network.
You've tuned in to All Together Now, WGXC's regional look at the news from Hudson Valley and the Capital Region, from the Catskills to the Berkshires and beyond. I'm Tom Rowe, and today you'll hear all sorts of local news updates, weather, interviews, and more, plus community events and the song of the day on All Together Now.
This is the news. This is the network. Network. This is the news. This is the news. This is the news. This is the network. Network.
On air, in air, waves.
Controlled.
On air, in air, channel.
Connection.
And the moon
turns to blood.
We interrupt this broadcast to bring you a special news bulletin.
Stay tuned to this station.
Stand by for news.
Direct via satellite from our on-the-spot task force.
Good evening from our newsroom in New York.
This is
Daily News and Weather Report.
We take you now to
this radio broadcast.
You are tuned in to All Together Now, a collaborative one-hour news show for community radio stations in the Capital Region and New York's Hudson Valley. All Together Now features contributions from the public, along with programmers at WOOC in Troy and WGXC in Accra, featuring local and regional news, weather updates, and newsmaker interviews. Next, the national headlines from Public News Service.
The Public News Service Daily Newscast for Tuesday, November the 6th, Election Day 2018. I'm Mike Clifford. Early voting shatters records as Americans head to the polls for today's midterm election day. Also on the Tuesday rundown, midterms won't tame tariff woes for farmers in the Midwest. Plus, good news for kids suing over climate change. Now our top story, a staggering 36 million voters cast their ballots ahead of Election Day this year. Political reports that is setting the stage for much higher than usual turnout for a midterm and potentially big surprises tonight. Republican enthusiasm for Trump and Democrats' itch to repudiate him at the ballot box have driven people to the polls far faster than in 2014. In that year, 27.2 million people voted early, according to Michael McDonald at the University of Florida. Politico says that trend is expected to extend into Election Day today. Voters in three states, Texas, Nevada, and Arizona, have already surpassed total turnout in the last midterm election. Meantime, voters do have some big choices to make on this election day. In Ohio, Mary Sherman reports, in addition to a statewide ballot measure, voters there will decide on several statewide races, including who will be the next governor.
Besides a statewide ballot measure, voters will decide on several statewide races, including who will be the next governor. There are also several races for seats in the U.S. House and one of Ohio's seats in the U.S. Senate. Executive Director of the League of Women Voters of Ohio, Jen Miller, encourages voters to do some research before heading to the polls and then remember to bring proper identification.
That can include the state of Ohio driver's license or a state ID, U.S. military ID, a current utility bill, paycheck, bank statement, even a speeding ticket, as long as it has your address on there, will work.
If getting to the polls is a challenge, Miller notes that in some counties, rideshare companies, public transit authorities, and political parties and organizations are offering free or discounted rides. The League of Women Voters has a phone number for information, 614-210-0746. This story was produced in association with Media in the Public Interest and funded in part by the George Gunn Foundation.
More than 1 million Ohio voters requested an absentee ballot, and more than half have already been submitted. And globalization has been both good and bad for American farmers. Ross Brown reports that fact is hitting home especially hard for Iowa soybean growers this fall.
Increased free trade opened up new soybean markets in Mexico, the European Union, and especially China. So far, Iowa farmers remain confident that President Donald Trump can navigate the trade war for better outcomes, according to Iowa State University economist Chad Hart. But he adds that the U.S. has never engaged in a trade dispute of this magnitude, where an economic power such as China has retaliated against us.
This was our biggest buyer by far, and there wasn't any other market close to being that same size. And that's been the problem. As that biggest market has shrunk dramatically, we just can't cobble together enough of the smaller markets to make up the loss.
Trump has imposed taxes on imports to encourage consumers to buy American products, but countries targeted have retaliated by imposing tariffs of their own.
While other countries have continued to buy soybeans from the U.S. to the tune of 3 million tons, it does not offset the loss of sales to China, which are down about 6 million tons from last year. If North Carolina's early voting is any indication, today's Election Day turnout will be significant.
Some credit get-out-the-vote efforts, including door-to-door canvassing and poll parties, for energizing citizens, and more than 70 See You at the Poll parties are planned for today. The North Carolina Collective of Nonpartisan Groups, known as Vote Together, wants to make midterm voting an enjoyable experience, as Fiona Shivers explains.
And the whole idea of these poll parties is to make voting fun again and also drive younger people out to the polls. People take midterm elections for granted, and they are actually the elections that hold the most power within our communities, and we want people to understand that.
Shivers is with the North Carolina League of Conservation Voters, a group that's part of Vote Together. The state has seen more than 170 on-site celebrations. This is Antoinette Kerr reporting.
The polls will be open until 7:30 tonight in about 2,700 precincts in North Carolina. And finally, the trial is back in the lawsuit brought by a group of 21 young people who are suing the federal government over global warming. That after a U.S. Supreme Court ruling against a request from the administration to block it.
Attorneys for the youths argue that the federal government is depriving the children of the constitutional right to life, liberty, and property by promoting policies that cause climate change. Stephanie Corcoran is an organizer with San Diego 350, a group that fights to end dependence on fossil fuels. She says the plaintiffs in the lawsuit are not seeking monetary compensation.
Their goal is actually for a change in policy. They would like the government to facilitate transition to clean energy and away from fossil fuels so that they inherit a planet that is conducive to life and will be better for them to live in.
The suit argues that the federal government is speeding up climate change by allowing oil and gas drilling on public land, supporting subsidies for fossil fuel companies, and pulling out of the Paris Climate Accords. The Justice Department has argued that the case should be dismissed because it is costing too much money to defend and is an attempt to circumvent the policies of a duly elected president.
I'm Mike Clifford. If you haven't already, please be sure to vote today. Thanks for newsing and cruising with Public News Service. We are member and listener supported, and we are online at publicnewsservice.org.
The National Weather Service in Albany predicts a rainy election day, 90% chance of showers and possibly a thunderstorm, mainly before 5 p.m. Scattered showers could continue Tuesday night, with a low around 43. Then Wednesday should be mostly sunny with a high near 53 and a low around 36. Thursday should also be mostly sunny with a high near 46 and a low around 32. I'm Tom Rowe for WGXC 90.7 FM, Acre, Catskill, Hudson, listener-supported, Creative Community Radio.
Listen to music and voices. Listen to work and play. Listen to eat and drink. Listen to noise and fun. Listen to pink and blue. Listen to a heart rainbow. Listen to wizards and witches. Listen to jazz play. Listen to dogs and mice. Listen to Rome and Italy. Listen to Mars and Venus. Listen to the planet. Listen to teeth and trunks. Listen to Kaizen and Violet. Listen to stars and stripes. Listen to Texas. Listen to bells and waterfalls. Listen to churches and steeples. Dance and sing and listen and bells. Listen to making things, stripes and zigzags. Bike riding and zigzagging. No, listen to bike riding and curving. Listen to the radio going on and on. Listen to the radio WGXC.
Tune in Wednesday, November 7th to WGXC. The Reverend Kim L. Singletary is on with There's a Bright Side Somewhere at 11 a.m. And then Spike Priggen plays rock music on the Bedazzled Radio Hour after the noon news. Ira Glass speaks for himself at 3 p.m. with a special remix of the This American Life show host. And Jeff Economy's in at 9:30 p.m. with the latest edition of Snack Point Charlie on 90.7 FM WGXC.
I'm Neva Wartell, and you, my friend, are...
Last I looked, Michelle Curtis. Nice to be here. Thank you. It's a beautiful day outside today.
It really is. Well, I wouldn't know here in the Carnegie Room, but it looks beautiful through the window. Yes, the sky is blue, and there's a bevy of children outside in the hall in the children's library here in the Catskill Public Library. They're having a Halloween party. And maybe some of the kids will come in and talk to us about their costumes.
Nope.
Hopefully.
Yeah.
But we're going to start out right at the top with our friend and neighbor, Foggy Otis, who has stopped in. He's got a new song, pre-election, to encourage everyone to get out and vote and do the right thing. So, we're going to get started. Yeah,
we're
going to hear the song. Foggy.
This is a Willie Nelson song, so my little interpretation. If you don't like who's in there, vote him out. That's what election day is all about. The biggest gun we've got is called the ballot box. If you don't like who's in there, vote him out. Vote them out. And when they're gone, we'll sing and dance and shout. And we'll bring the new ones in and start that show again. If you don't like who's in there, vote them out. Your clowns you voted in. election day is coming round again. And if you don't like them now, you can change it anyhow. If you don't like who's in there, vote them out. Vote them out. Vote them out. When they're gone, we'll sing and dance and shout. Then we'll bring the new ones in and start it up again. If you don't like who's in there, vote them out. If you don't like who's in there, vote them out. If you don't like who's in there, vote them out.
Next, we have these reports.
And in the studio with me now is Phoebe Potter, who is mounting a write-in campaign in Halcott, Lexington, and Hunter for the Greene County Legislature. Welcome, Phoebe.
Thank you, Tom. Good to be here.
Good to have you here, too. Tell us, why are you trying to, I guess it's kind of a last-minute write-in campaign.
quite, yes. So I've been really actively involved in the Mountaintop community. I grew up up there. I was gone for some time, came back 2 years ago. And one of the things that really pulled me in as a community organizer is this whole jail debate that's been happening in Greene County. And after the legislature voted for the jail on September 19th, I had a number of requests from organizing peers about, would I be a write-in? Would I challenge Larry Gardner, who's one of the 10 legislators who voted for the jail in the end? And, you know, I didn't say yes right away. I had some hesitancy about jumping in quickly. I ideally would love to have a little more time up here, getting to know the community even more deeply and rooting into some of the work I'm doing up here. But as we went into the public hearing that you just talked about on the air on this past, what day was that?
Thursday night, November 1st, I believe.
Yeah. You know, there were still some queries coming in, and something somebody said to me just really resonated, which is, it's great that you would love to run in 3 years. What's going to happen over the next three while a lot of these really important decisions about the jail are made, while we're looking at some of the champions against the jail, Lori Torgerson and Aidan O'Connor, not coming back to the county legislature this coming term. So the urgency just really spoke to me, and I decided that night, actually during the hearing, that yes, I would put my hat in the ring and be a person that people could write in for District 7, which is, you know, where I live, you know, to really voice their concerns about the fiscal and social impacts of this jail decision and the larger lack of leadership I think it represents in our county for fighting for what we need.
All right. Well, let's we'll get back to the jail in a second. Why don't you give us your basic biography background first?
Sure. Yeah. So, I grew up, I kind of made my way up the mountaintop. I was born in Kingston and then lived in Hunter for a while and then Roxbury. And finally, my family settled in Gilboa. So that's where I was mostly raised. I went to Gilboa Conesville Central School and graduated there in 2005. And just, you know, always loved up here. But I left after school and did a 4-year degree at Hamilton College. And there I really got deeply interested in policy. I was studying economics. I was studying government. And I ended up doing a master's degree after that at Georgetown studying public policy issues. And got really drawn into the intersection of kind of fiscal policy and social policy as it relates to the criminal justice system. It just became a particular policy issue that I realized kind of impacted all the other policy issues, the amount of money we're spending, taxation, housing, social welfare. And so I ended up working for the Department of Justice, actually, for a little while, and then spent most of my 20s working as a consultant for the Council of State Governments. And that organization did a lot of consulting with state and local governments, with corrections departments, with other agencies on how to reduce corrections spending, which is so bloated all across the country, in a way that actually increases public safety and improves the sorts of outcomes that drive incarceration in the first place. And so I designed programming. I trained probation departments. I worked with the heads of corrections departments on their overall policy approach to criminal justice. And I worked all over the country doing that, literally with state correction department in Alaska, Florida, California, and even New York State for some of my work. So I did that for quite some time. I was kind of in that world for 7 years. But then I had a kind of a larger political epiphany of sorts, which was that at the end of the day, the best ideas are generated by the people who are directly dealing with them on the ground, that communities have the best solutions. And unfortunately, they're oftentimes the least empowered voices in a room about what kind of governing decisions need to be made. And I felt it was time for me to go to the community that felt most like home to me. And I moved back up here. And I was also interested in being more involved in community programming. So I actually worked for the Prattsville Arts Center on a one-year grant when I first moved up here. So right away, I was kind of dropped into community programming. And that felt really great. And now that I'm up here, it's no question I will be up here forever. And have really settled into living in Westkill, which is my home. I live on Spruceton Road. I love the community there. I love the sense of collectivism that's really alive in that area. And, you know, have been now kind of seeding a number of projects that are special to me. I work at the Youth Clubhouse, actually doing a radio program in collaboration with WGXC, which has been really fun. And I'm in the process of founding an artist co-op with a number of other local artists who grew up on the mountaintop. It's called the Phoenix Web Cooperative. And we run the Free Mart that has been in Prattsville for the last year. And we're looking for our new winter home at the moment. So yeah, I have my hands in a couple different projects, but just deeply in love with this community, and that's basically who I am.
So the jail issue is your main issue, and you actually have a background in knowing something about local jails and prisons.
A lot. Yeah, this question that our county was confronted on is exactly the question that I would work with state and county governments on at these kind of critical junctures that come up in the system, where something like a jail needing to close down brings up all these larger questions about what is our criminal justice system made out of? What are all the different elements? And when I moved back, Lori Torgerson actually invited me to be a member of the Public Safety Committee's Alternatives to Incarceration Committee. And so that was myself and a couple other members of the public, but mostly it was people in the system. We had the head of probation, the district attorney, the public defender, the head of the mental health and substance abuse program. So we were all collectively on this committee for a good 6 months, and we put forward recommendations to the Public Safety Committee of the legislature that A, dispelled essentially the sort of population projections that we had been basing the jail build on, and then brought forward some alternative ways of dealing with it, which included proactive ways to keep our pretrial population low. I think there's this idea that we don't have any control over the size of our jail. That's not true. Counties have a ton of agency in determining how they want to handle people who've been arrested but not yet convicted of a crime, which is what a jail is mostly housing, is folks in that category. And the shared jail was one of the concepts that came out of that committee that we recommended be looked at as a much cheaper, viable option. And where my frustration has come up is that the jail passed with a kind of bias toward wanting an answer that was, we can't share a jail. And the due diligence around that, the miscommunication, the misinformation about whether or not that was a legal option was just so problematic throughout the entire time. My experience was that the ATI committee put in its report and the legislators kind of checked the box. We did something to show that we're thinking about this, and just kind of carried on with what they wanted to do. So
they were saying that it was illegal to share a jail with another county as they were currently sharing a jail with another county. So the question is, why haven't they arrested themselves?
Right.
And put themselves in their own jail, or the jail they're sharing illegally with another county right now.
Right. Where do you put the people who illegally build? I don't know. It's a complicated question.
to me, the whole issue, and I don't know if it breaks down this way to you, but the whole issue to me, and this is, I don't understand how they voted on an issue when they've never answered this question. And this question to me is, it's either how much are taxes going to go up if we build a new jail, or B, how many jobs are going to be lost if we share a jail? And I don't understand why those two numbers have never come out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I agree. And they're the two things that kind of galvanized, I think, kind of an emotional response, the job loss piece, right? There was a lot of, I think, miscommunication around that. The sign, I don't
know. I've heard 28 at one point. Do you have any idea how many jobs would be lost?
There wouldn't be, there's a possibility that we wouldn't lose any jobs. And I think this was kind of the front, when the proposal was on the table to do a feasibility study of a shared jail with Hudson, that would be one of the questions we'd be answering, right? I mean, we would be expanding some of the capacity at the Hudson jail to make sure that it, you know, could safely accommodate the full population of both counties. The cost of that capital improvement was $7.5 million. We're talking about $70 million for a new jail, so clearly much cheaper. And then that would, you know, we would then be encouraging our corrections staff who are under the sheriff's office to be able to work in that setting. But there's a lot of other jobs as well that those folks do in a sheriff's office that we would still absolutely need. So that's a piece of it.
But they voted against the study to find out the answer to that
exactly,
question.
Exactly. And in terms of the new job creation, right, with building the jail, which is the other side of the equation, what I'm actually getting the picture that we're going to lose jobs, because they're describing this new jail design as one that has a much higher sort of inmate to correctional officer ratio. So you need fewer people in the jail to staff it. And so they've been slowly letting folks go from retirement or whatever and not planning, and they're not planning on backfilling those positions.
So how many jobs have been lost by
I don't know exactly
voting for the new jail?
Right, exactly. I'm not sure how many people have attrited out in that time period. There were two new positions proposed, which were transition officers who would work in the jail and help with some reentry planning. So those would have been new jobs. But again, those are positions that we could be funding anyway. We could be funding caseworkers who do prisoner reentry. We could be funding other types of social work positions and things that work in the jail, whether it's Hudson or otherwise. We could be putting our resources into our probation staff who do a lot of that legwork on the ground when folks come back from jail. So the idea that if we save $70 million by not building a jail, that we would lose jobs in Greene County just seems outrageous to me.
And then the cost of the new jail, I mean, the taxes first, the tax question. I think William Lawrence had a column in the Greenville Pioneer about 2 weeks ago with a whole bunch of figures and statistics and stuff. And it basically said every town in the county, every person in those towns would pay just under 7% higher taxes, I think, starting next year. Is that a figure that is correct, or is that pulled out of thin air, or
I can't speak to the validity of those numbers. I know we've had a hard time getting clarity of numbers. There was a point when, you know, there was an FAQ that was put out by the legislature about it, and, you know, they just sort of took the total tax burden divided by every person in the county and said, this is how much it'll cost per person. I'm like, well, children don't pay taxes. Like, you know, a large portion of the population doesn't apply to. If you actually break that
number
means it down,
would, the number would go way up, right? Because if you take out the children.
Yeah, if you apply it to the number of people who are actually paying property tax, who are the ones who are going to foot the bill, it's a much smaller number that you're spreading that cost across. And that's why there were so many property taxpayers who really rallied against the jail and were the vocal ones speaking out about their concerns. I don't know exactly what it's going to play out in terms of the exact tax increase. Obviously, taxes get impacted by lots of funding decisions, but I just keep coming back to the number, which is $70 million that we're going to have to pay for in taxes that we otherwise wouldn't have to, plus the ongoing operation of our corrections of a jail, which we haven't seen great numbers on that either. Has anybody seen a really clear budget for what the annual operating costs of this jail will be that has way larger square footage and requirements that staffing is based on the capacity of the jail, not how many people are in there? None of those things have been answered yet either.
And then on Thursday, They basically took all that, all the numbers that they based the vote on and threw them out the window and said they're actually going to be much higher, probably, right?
Kind of. I think they've been using different numbers to confuse things. I mean, we've known all along that it would be a $70 million bill because you're looking at...
That's counting the interest or not?
That incorporates the interest, Exactly. So
they were a lot often, the people, the proponents for the new jail were citing a number that did not include the interest, but the interest has to be paid.
Absolutely. Right. And so Grodin was clear about that in, you know, Administrator Grodin in his, on that hearing, broke it down and said, yes,
this,
indeed.
The hearing this past Thursday, November 1st.
It is indeed $70 million. That number came out of his mouth, which includes what we're taking out in terms of a loan expenses for building the jail, the interest on that, plus the $8 million that we will be paying straight out of pocket from our existing reserves.
They've created this reserve of $8 million that they have right now waiting to spend this.
They're on the, they're building up now. I think they have 5 of 8.
1, 2, 3, ah! 1, 2, 3, 4, can I have a little more? 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, I love you. A, B, C, D, can I bring my friend? H-I-J, I love you. Sail the ship. Jump the tree. Skip the rope. Look at me. All together now. All together now.
Hi, I'm Lila from Athens, New York. You're listening to WGXC 90.7 FM ACRA.
Fridays on WGXC are made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Shelley Wiener of Germantown, New York. Sustaining supporters like Shelley are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by the First Presbyterian Church of Hudson, a faith community open to all. Whether you are single, married, divorced, gay, wealthy, poor, or no habla inglés, if you are just browsing, just woke up, or just got out of jail, it doesn't matter if you work on Wall Street or if you sleep on Wall Street, you belong. We love soccer moms, crying babies, vegans, hipsters, seekers and doubters, tourists and locals. All are welcome. Services held Sunday mornings at 10:45 a.m. You can find us on the web at firstpreshudson.org.
Next, we have these reports.
Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Corinne Carey attended a debate between candidates for the 107th Assembly District, an area that runs from the town of Cambridge to Hillsdale and includes parts of Troy and Albany.
On Wednesday, October 17th, the Eastwick Press sponsored a candidate debate between Democrat Tistria Hotling and Republican Jake Ashby, candidates vying to represent the 107th Assembly District here in New York. The candidates took questions from a panel of journalists and then from the audience. We'll hear excerpts from each of the candidates' opening statements and then clips from answers to questions from the panel and the audience.
Thank all of you for coming out and being here tonight. And I do also want to thank my opponent, Jake Ashby, who is a veteran, for his service to our country. I think it's very important that we ensure that our veterans have access to the services that they deserve. As the town clerk, I fought very hard to ensure that all of my residents have access to services. In New Lebanon, we're a rural community and we're 45 minutes away from Hudson, where the services are located. So we've worked on bringing those services out into our rural community to ensure that people have access. That is why I've become a public servant. I think it's very important that all people have access to the support that they need to thrive. Unfortunately, right now, our government is not working for us. We have a head of the EPA that does not believe in climate change. We have a head of the education department that does not believe in publicly funded education. We have a tax plan that benefits the billionaires while the working class struggles. Here in New York State, we have to push back against the environmental rollbacks that are happening. We have to ensure that we have clean water to drink and clean air to breathe. We need to protect the funding to our schools to ensure that all children have access to a quality education. And we have to fight back against the tax plan to ensure that the breaks to the billionaires don't fall on the backs of our seniors and our working class. My name is Tistria Hoatley. I'm a mother, a local town clerk, and a part-time music teacher. I was born and raised in New Lebanon, New York, and now my husband Steve and I are raising our three children in New Lebanon. We're a blue-collar working-class family, and like many of you, we are fed up with the results that we get from Albany. We work hard, we pay our taxes, and we expect our state representatives to be there for us when our communities struggle, or worse, face a crisis. Unfortunately, for too long, the 107th Assembly District has gotten no results from Albany. While corrupt politicians hold office, our residents are facing a drinking water crisis in Nassau and Hoosick Falls and Petersburg. Too many of our young people are falling victim to the opioid crisis. We have crumbling roads and infrastructure, and too many communities that still don't have access to broadband internet. We have dairy farmers that are falling deeper and deeper into debt in a state that has almost 20 million people for them to deliver the fruits of their labor. The people of Rensselaer, Washington, and Columbia County deserve better. We deserve results, and we deserve a voice. My name is Tistria Hoatley. I am not running to be something. I am running to do something. Thank you.
My name is Jake Ashby, and I want to thank everyone for joining us tonight. I'm proud to be serving as your Assemblyman and to represent my neighbors as a committed and independent voice for upstate. Four generations of the Ashby family live in this Assembly District, and this is one of the reasons why I'm running for this seat. I have a commitment to serving others and working to make a difference in their lives, serving country and community. This is what led me to join the Army after the September 11th attacks. I was initially rejected for medical reasons, but I appealed to my Congressman Mike McNulty to earn my commission. In the Army, I served with combat units in Iraq and Afghanistan. I worked to bring freedom and stability to desperate areas. I stood up to tribal leaders who wanted to keep their people, especially women and young children, oppressed. When we were in Africa, we worked with local leaders to provide medical care. We coordinated the successful delivery of medical services, including life-changing surgeries, malaria prevention strategies, and aid to mothers infected with HIV. When I returned from these deployments, I continued to serve others as an occupational therapist, eventually starting my own practice. I know firsthand the difficulties our seniors and those facing medical challenges encounter every day. This is not something I've read about. This is something I do and have done for the last 16 years. As you can see, I'm not afraid of a fight. I'm not afraid to stand up to our governor when I think he's wrong. I'm not afraid to stand up to my own party when I think they're wrong. I had to fight to get into the Assembly, winning a special election when I was outspent 5-1. My commitment to serve you and to protect taxpayers, create new opportunities, safeguard freedoms, ensure clean drinking water, and erase corruption at every opportunity I get.
One of the first questions was about economic development in the region. We'll hear first from Jake Ashby.
That's a good question. I can tell you what we're not doing. We're not thinking of starting a movie theater in Syracuse, paying $15 million for it, promising 350 jobs, and only getting one job for it, then having to sell it to Onondaga County for a dollar. That's economic development under this governor. That's economic development under the Democrat Party. We're not talking about Startup New York, which, again, we're investing over $64 million in a gap. What have we gotten at it, other than frustration, other than a want for a better small business climate in our area? We're not talking about things like that. I know that the minority, the Republican minority, is fighting against ideas like this, and I'm going to continue to do so.
We need to look at our issues here in this district, and we need to combine them. So as I'm knocking on doors, I'm hearing there's a real need for quality jobs. We also have a senior aging population that needs ways to age comfortably in their own homes. So we need to link those two things together and create quality jobs for people to come in and care for our seniors, which is less expensive than nursing home care. And so we need to look at how we are keeping money local. I'd like to look at options to have caveats in our procurement policy that says if we're buying milk for our prisons and our schools, we're buying them from dairy farmers right here in New York State. Let's keep our money in our economy. When we look at things like tax breaks for the Walmarts and the Amazons of the world, yet small businesses are struggling to survive, we need to stop the race to the bottom, and we need to figure out how to encourage small business growth. And so I think we're looking at things backwards. We're letting the rich get richer, we're giving tax breaks to the large corporations, and we're taking our jobs out of the district. We need to look at how to keep our money and our economy thriving right here in New York State.
A member of the audience asked a question about healthcare, stating that $18,000 was the cost for covering a family of three.
I hear you. Here in the United States, we pay the highest per person for healthcare, the highest in the world. Yet, we're 24th for life expectancy. So what that means is we're paying the most money, and we're not getting the best care. We have pharmaceutical companies. We have insurance companies that are making billions of dollars off of us being sick. We need to take the profit out of our healthcare industry. In 2009, 46% of bankruptcies that were filed here in the United States were filed because of medical reasons. Almost half of the people that had to declare bankruptcy did it because they or someone in their family got sick or injured. Like you said in your question, we're already paying the money. It's not like going to a single-payer system means that we're paying money that we weren't paying before. Right now, we're paying at $18,000 a year for health insurance. I'm going to assume when you go to the doctor, you're paying copays, you're paying deductibles, right? So that it doesn't end there. $18,000 a year doesn't mean that you get all your medical care covered. So single payer means we're taking the profit away from the pharmaceutical companies, which is why they've spent so much money lobbying against it, because they don't want to lose out on all that money. And all it's doing is paying for it in a different way.
We have single payer. We have Medicaid in New York State. We have $160 billion budget for Medicaid. We also have the VA, which is the second largest federal budget that we have. Having worked in healthcare for the last 16 years and trying to work with the VA and Medicaid, I can tell you that it's atrocious. When we talk about increasing the cost for this, you also have to consider the impact that it's going to have on quality and accessibility. And we've seen that over the course of the years in New York State as our Medicare budget has continued to grow and grow and grow, and the same with the VA. I'm not for that. I'm for quality health care.
One of the most divisive questions of the evening was on the legalization of marijuana. The candidates held distinctly different positions, and so did the audience.
I am in support of the legalization of recreational marijuana. I have a few reasons. The first reason is that I worked in the court system, the local court system, for 6 years. What I saw is our police officers spending time, resources to issue tickets. Then the court staff, myself, time, resources to process tickets. Then we had the judge, we had the DA's office, we had the public defender in most of these cases. We spent a lot of time, money, and resources. And at the end of the day, you know what happened? Nothing. We said, it's okay. It's pretty much already legal. But what we're doing is we're spending time, money, and resources to go through this whole process to say, you're going to walk away and it's fine. The second reason is instead of spending all this money to do something that's pretty much already okay in our state, we could actually be making money. Colorado last year made $247 million. We're three times the population of Colorado. That's almost $750 million. We talked earlier about the opioid crisis, treatment. Where's the funding going to come from? Let's take that $700 million from legalizing marijuana and put it into treating a real drug addiction that needs services and help and treatment.
I do not support the legalization. It sounded a lot in what my opponent was saying, that she was looking more at the decriminalization of it rather than the legalization of it. But when we look at Colorado, even from a publication like the Denver Post, been several articles that have been written on what it's done to the social welfare system within Denver, Boulder, and Pueblo, and the costs that the criminal justice system is having over there has been extremely detrimental.
There was some agreement between the two candidates on the issue of term limits, fighting corruption, and also addressing the opioid epidemic. But there were stark differences in their positions on immigration and the support of Sheriff Russo's implementation of the 287G program, fracking, and the SAFE Act.
I'm in favor of repealing the SAFE Act in its entirety. I'm the only candidate here that's endorsed by NYSERPA, and I take all of our rights seriously. There's things going on right now with the SAFE Act that I don't think many people are aware of because of the fact that it was passed through a message of necessity in the middle of the night, and it was written so poorly that even our law enforcement officers were in violation of the law the very next day, and they had to go back and they had to re-amend it. We have people right now that are getting their pistol permits revoked by surrogate judges in the county because they're following the law, they're following New York State guidance. Where's the due process in that? I am a pro-2A candidate, and you know I will continue to fight for that.
So my husband is an avid hunter. We are a responsible gun-owning family. We have about 20 guns in the house, locked safely in a gun safe. I grew up with guns. My dad was a hunter. I learned how to shoot as a child, and I learned about gun safety. I'm also a mother. I'm also a community member. I'm also a concerned citizen. I don't think this is an either-or issue. I think that we can protect the Second Amendment and the rights of responsible gun owners like my husband while still keeping our children and our families safe. What can we agree on? Can we agree that we need to keep the guns out of the wrong hands? I think we could all agree on that. So how do we do that? Can we all agree that we don't need a weapon of war? A weapon that Mr. Ashby and Mr. Glad went through extensive training in the military to learn how to use.
The candidates also had distinctly different approaches to expanding broadband access to internet service.
As we see the small business climate improve in our region, that we will see internet be brought out to these areas. It's a matter of infrastructure. And when we're able to bring and augment our abilities to have this infrastructure in these areas, we're going to see internet come out there as well.
Jake mentioned small businesses. Expand small businesses and the internet will come. I disagree. I think expand the internet and the small business will come.
Incumbent Republican Jake Ashby will face off against his Democratic challenger, Tistria Hoetling, in the general election, which will be held on Tuesday, November 6th.
That was Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Corinne Carey with a report from the candidate debate sponsored by the Eastwick Press between incumbent Republican Assemblyman Jake Ashby and his challenger, Democratic Tistria Hoetling.
From the WGXC newsroom, this is the WGXC Hands-On Radio News Update. I'm Philip Grant. Sarah Tapton is reporting for Columbia Green Media. The Greene County Legislature will hold a public hearing Monday, November 5th on its proposed 2019 budget. Finance Committee Chairman Charles Martinez, a Republican representing Coxsackie, said the spending plan totals $119 million, a significant increase in spending over last year. Greene County Administrator Sean Groden said allocations that increase the budget include costs associated with the Raise the Age legislation and the capital improvement project at Columbia Greene Community College. Martinez said that the tax levy increase is 2% within the state-mandated guidelines for the seventh consecutive year. Groden said the legislature's approval of the $39 million bond to finance the construction of a new county jail in Coxsackie presents new challenges for the county. He said the bond will contribute $300,000 to the county's debt service during the coming year. Martinez said, in addition, the cost associated with boarding the incarcerated outside of the county has doubled, so jail-related payroll, overtime, utilities, and other expenses have been reduced. On the revenue side, there has been an increase in sales tax income over the last year, from $30 million to $31 million, Groden said. Treasurer Peter Marcoux said in 2017, the county's revenue was nearly $110 million, according to a recent audit. Its combined fund balance was just under $38.5 million, which is more than $29.2 million in cash on hand. Public hearing on the 2019 Greene County budget will be held at 6 p.m. on Monday, November 5th at Catskill Middle School, 345 West Main Street. The full legislature will vote on the spending plan November 20th, and you can read the full story at HudsonValley360.com. Columbia Greene Media is reporting former Columbia County Treasurer and Ghent Town Supervisor Kenneth H. Wilbur passed away on October 27th following a long illness.
Wilbur served on the Ghent Town Board from 1980 to 1981 and as town supervisor from 1982 to 1993. In 1996, he was elected Columbia County Treasurer and served in that position until his retirement in 2011. Before being elected treasurer, Wilbur was employed for 30 years at the Columbia Corporation in Chatham. He was the former vice chairman of the Columbia County Republican Committee. Wilbur was born in 1946 in Hudson, graduated from Chatham High School and Albany Business College. He served in the U.S. Navy during the Vietnam War and was honorably discharged in October 1971. Wilbur was a third-generation member of the Ghent Marching and Concert Band, a life member of the Ghent Veterans of Foreign War Post No. 5933, and the Ghent Volunteer Fire Department. Wilbur is survived by his wife of 51 years, Jeanette Loster Wilbur, their children and grandchildren. Read the full story at HudsonValley360.com. A new poll out from the Education Research Center offers a profile of voters 18 and 19 years old who will cast a ballot November 6th for the first time. More than 1,300 young people who have never participated in a general election submitted to the online survey last month. 63% of those who responded said they plan to vote, and the top reason for going to the polls, and I quote, "It's good for the country when people vote," end quote. Respondents were asked a total of 25 questions covering a variety of topics, including the extent of their civics education, the source of the information they rely on to decide how to vote, and if they are more politically engaged today than 2 years ago. Among the responses, 55% had taken a civics class in high school. 39% used information they received from family members to decide how to vote, and 52% said their level of political engagement has increased in the past 2 years. Those who plan to vote are more likely to be suburban, identify as liberal, be Asian, and identify school shooting as their top concern. Students who do not plan to vote are more likely to identify as politically moderate, be unengaged in civic activities, and identify their top concern as guns or gun control. The top three economic problems identified by respondents were the high cost of living and inflation, the economy in general, and the gap between the rich and poor. The most important social or political problem identified included school shootings, guns and gun control, race relations and racism, and immigration. A link to the full youth survey is available at the WGXC newsroom page at WGXC.org. Dana Rubenstein is reporting for Politico New York. U.S. Senators Chuck Schumer and Kirsten Gillibrand are trying to get Amtrak and the Metropolitan Transportation Authority to stop their bickering. In a letter to MTA Chairman Joe LaHota and Amtrak President Richard Anderson dated November 2nd, the two senators pointed out that New York depends on both organizations to work collaboratively. Specifically, Schumer and Gillibrand expressed their concern about ongoing repairs to Amtrak's Hurricane Sandy-damaged East River tunnels, bringing Metro North Railroad service to Penn Station by way of the Bronx, and bringing Long Island Railroad service to a new terminal beneath Grand Central, a project called East Side Access. Despite their independency, that collaboration has not been Amtrak's and the MTA's strong suit. In October, an MTA official blamed Amtrak for a breakdown in negotiations over a deal to bring Metro North service to Penn Station via an existing Amtrak right-of-way in the Bronx. And in May, the two squabbled over Amtrak's plan to overhaul its Penn Station concourse. Amtrak spokesperson Christina Leeds insisted the two organizations are working together. A spokesperson for the MTA had no immediate comment. Read the full story at Politico New York. And that wraps up the WGXC Hands-On Radio News Update. For local weather reports, public meetings, and other community information, use the WGXC website, WGXC.org. From the WGXC Newsroom, I'm Philip Graham. Have a good day and a pleasant tomorrow.
The National Weather Service in Albany predicts a rainy election day, 90% chance of showers and possibly a thunderstorm. mainly before 5 p.m. Scattered showers could continue Tuesday night, with a low around 43. Then Wednesday should be mostly sunny with a high near 53 and a low around 36. Thursday should also be mostly sunny with a high near 46 and a low around 32. I'm Tom Rowe for WGXC 90.7 FM, Acre, Catskill, Hudson, listener-supported Creative Community Radio. Tuesday night, election night, there's lots of extra broadcasts on WGXC. 6:15, there's public hearings before the Town of Catskill meeting. Tune in by clicking on Listen Now at any WGXC webpage for the Town of Catskill meeting at 6:30 p.m. Tuesday, November 6th. Then the Leper's Garden Death Metal Show is on at 7 p.m. on WGXC 90.7 FM. At the same time at 7 p.m., Democracy Now! Begins their election coverage on our All Together Now! Web stream. Again, click on Listen Now on any WGXC webpage and scroll down to find the All Together Now! Web stream to hear Democracy Now!'s coverage of election night. There's more election results at 9:30 p.m. on the Battlefield Earth Show, and also at midnight on WGXC 90.7 FM, Acre, Catskill, Hudson, listener-supported Creative Community Radio. There were some last-minute shenanigans before the Tuesday, November 6th election. On Monday, November 5th, Steve Greenfield, the Green Party candidate who's running for Congress in the 19th Congressional District against Diane Neal, Antonio Delgado, and John Faso, released this message on Facebook. It said, "It has come to my attention that today I became the beneficiary," that's in quotes, "of a Citizens United-permitted PAC in Texas that has delivered over $48,000 worth of mailers and social media ads attacking Antonio Delgado and comparing him unfavorably to me. This is my temporary response while I prepare a press release, and I'd appreciate it if you share it." He said, "This message is not from me, my campaign, or any PAC supporting me. It is not from the Green Party or any PAC supporting us. This is from Republicans. I denounce both the message and the messengers." After WGXC posted that message on our Facebook page, he wrote back that the flyer was not spent on my behalf. "The mailer is as much an attack on me as on the Democrats, and you can see just by looking at my website, reading my campaign Facebook posts, and listening to my radio ad that it does not reflect anything about me or how I'm presenting my own campaign. I've never singled out Delgado from Faso for comparison to my platform. I've never targeted Democratic Party audiences, focusing almost exclusively on the 50% non-voter pool. The mailing is an outside attack and definitely not in my support." You can go to WGXC's Facebook page to see both complete statements from Steve Greenfield. The other story that broke just before the election is that Half Moon Republican Daphne Jordan is no longer a member of Senator Kathy Marchione's staff, and her office won't explain why. Jordan is running against Democrat Aaron Glad to replace Kathy Marchione in the state Senate. And apparently on Monday, November 5th, she was moved off of Marchione's staff and moved on to the Senate Republican Central staff, making the same biweekly salary, according to the Albany Times-Union's Capital Confidential blog, who got that fact from the latest payroll records. She previously was the legislative and committee director for Marchione. A spokesperson for Daphne Jordan declined to explain what happened. WGXC will be following the election all day and looking for other shenanigans, strange robocalls, sign stealing, and more. We should have a report from Sam Sebrin at the Athens polling place, and anyone is invited to call in and talk about what's going on with the election at WGXC's call-in line, 518-291-WGXC. Leave a 3-minute message there, and we will play it on the air. Tune in to special programming on Election Day, Tuesday, November 6th. On the WGXC Morning Show, Andrea Mitchell, the Catskill resident who's been featured in political ads about her health care during this congressional campaign, discusses the issue. And Max Ocean, one of the owners of the Livingston-based Subversive Malting and Brewing Company, talks about the Catskill Beer Cafe that they're opening at 414 Main Street in Catskill. That's on the WGXC Morning Show from 9 to 11, live from High Low in Catskill. Then Neva Wartell has Music for the Masses after the noon news. 2 p.m., local booksellers Brian Donahue.
There is nothing wrong with your television set. Do not attempt to adjust the picture. We are controlling transmission. If we wish to make it louder, we will bring up the volume. If we wish to make it softer, we will tune it to a whisper. We will control the horizontal. We will control the vertical. We can roll the image, make it flutter. We can change the focus to a soft blur or sharpen it to crystal clarity. For the next hour, sit quietly and we will control all that you see and hear. We repeat, there is nothing wrong with your television set. You are about to participate in a great adventure. You are about to experience the awe and mystery which reaches from the inner mind to the outer limits.
This is Echo. You are listening to WJFC Agra, Creative Community Magical Radio.
I'm a rogue.